AM in Hong Kong, 1800 hours in London and 1600 hours in Sao Paulo. You're with Monocle 24, live from London. Midori House starts now.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. In the next hour, we'll be heading over to Washington to preview this weekend's crucial debate in the race to become the Republican candidate for president. And we'll also be asking what a 40-year-old PhD thesis on Congo says about one of those candidates, Newt Gingrich. Then it's off to Dubai to find out why the Emirates is becoming the place to check into hospital for the global elite. And finally, we'll be talking about the unusual links between art and science.
Creativity, the impulse to go beyond paradigms, is shared by both, but art and science express them in different ways.
And we'll also be joined by a quantum physicist talking about his artwork. All that plus a couple of songs right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But before all that, here's the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. France and Germany are lobbying conservative European leaders today to back a plan to defuse the Eurozone's debt crisis ahead of a high-stakes EU summit. Paris and Berlin need to win backing quickly for their plan to amend the European Union's Lisbon Treaty to toughen budget discipline if they are to have it ready, as they hope, by March. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso told reporters he expected EU leaders to bring solutions to the summit.
What I expect from all heads of state and government is that they don't come saying what they cannot do, but what they will do for Europe. All the world is watching us, and what the world attends from us is not more national problems, but European solutions.
Chairman of Eurozone Finance Minister Jean-Claude Juncker said today a treaty change for just the 17 euro countries could not be excluded as an option to forge deeper fiscal integration among the single currency bloc needed to resolve the zone's worsening sovereign debt crisis, but added a treaty change for the whole EU bloc would be his preferred option. The Dutch Finance Minister Jan Kees de Jager says all members of the Eurozone should expect to be punished if they allow budgets to run out of control.
If a member state still is not willingly to accept the rules of the Stability and Growth Pact, then in the end they should be enforced almost to have the right budget, to have sound finances.
Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swiss ambassador who represents US interests in the country to condemn what it said was a US violation of its airspace. Iran's military said on Sunday it had shot down a US reconnaissance drone in eastern Iran. An official in the US said there was no indication the aircraft had been shot down. President Obama said the United States was considering all options on Iran and would work with allies, including Israel, to prevent Tehran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. The world's major economies have set conditions on a global deal to combat climate change at the 17th Conference of the Parties in Durban. Global aid groups, scientists and leaders have warned that a failure to achieve any concrete action on UN climate talks could have disastrous effects. Kiribati's Environment Minister Amboroti Nkura urged the plenary session to act decisively, as for his country and many other small island nations threatened by rising sea levels, it's literally a matter of life and death.
It is today that we need to ratchet up our efforts rather than later. Our survival is at stake, and it cannot wait any longer.
Russia said today that time was running out to conclude a missile defense deal with NATO, as the alliance insisted it would press ahead with a project it says is aimed at countering threats from states such as Iran. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen rejected Moscow's complaints the alliance isn't listening to its concerns the defense system could be used against it.
This system does not threaten Russia, nor does it alter the strategic balance. And as we face the same threat, it makes sense for us to cooperate in defending against it.
The head of the Arab League says Syria should sign an Arab League proposed peace plan as soon as possible if it wants to avert economic penalties from Arab states over its 8-month crackdown on protesters. Arab League Secretary General Nabil Al-Arabi said he held talks with senior officials in Iraq, which borders Syria, to explore whether the Iraqi government is willing to exert its influence with Syria to agree to an Arab plan. And finally, Brazil's Trade and Industry Minister faced pressure today to explain his personal wealth becoming the latest and one of the most high-profile members of President Dilma Rousseff's cabinet to be targeted by the media over alleged ethics breaches. Six members of Rousseff's cabinet have quit over corruption allegations since she took office in January. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. Now a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Europe, and it certainly feels very cold across Western Europe, mainly because of the wind. In the Alps, snow becoming heavy Wednesday night, and an Atlantic storm is heading for northern Britain and Ireland. The impact will be felt during Thursday, high winds causing some damage and disruption to transport even. High winds will also affect Germany and Denmark Friday. Here's Thursday's city forecast. London, 10 Celsius, windy with rain showers. Frankfurt, 8 degrees, partly cloudy and windy. Helsinki, 3 Celsius, rain and windy too. Prague, 6 degrees, partly cloudy. And air travel, disrupted weather across northern parts of Europe over the next couple of days, UK and Germany in particular. And in North America, the northeast of the US is gearing up for some snow. Parts of Pennsylvania, upstate New York and New England, 10 to 20 centimetres of snow through Wednesday night into Thursday local time. New York City itself, no snow here this time. The rest of the US, cold, calm and sunny. Here's Thursday's city outlook. In Manhattan itself, 7 Celsius, afternoon sunshine. Chicago, plus 1 and sunny. Miami, 24 and sunny. In Vancouver, 5 degrees with sunshine. A look at some other destinations around the world for the next couple of days. Brazil and Rio de Janeiro, a mix of sun and showers, 27 degrees here. In South Africa, Cape Town, a mix of sun and cloud too. Highs in the low to mid-20s. And in Dubai, 25 degrees with sunshine for many days to come. And finally, Japan and Tokyo, predominantly overcast with a little rain for the next couple of days. 7 degrees here. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It is 18:07 here in London. We're off to Washington after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It's been billed as the Alpha Dog Debate. Republican contenders Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney will go head-to-head this Saturday in the first debate since the Gingrich surge began. The former speaker is now leading most polls in Iowa, which holds the first caucus of the long primary season on the 3rd of January. With Herman Cain out and pretty much every other candidate on the right having already had their time in the sun, it'll be the first real test of Gingrich as the anyone-but-Romney candidate. So what can we expect? Joining me on the line from Washington now is our DC correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, this is the 12th debate that we've had in this rather long Republican calendar. This is the one really where it gets serious, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are starting to see that the Gingrich challenge is a little more well-rounded and serious than any of the other contenders that Romney has sort of faced down one-on-one. I think there was a moment where people thought that Rick Perry could be that sort of play that role, but Gingrich is, you know, he's a serious guy. He has the sort of by far the most impressive record of accomplishment, both political and policy in the field, and he's really formidable as a talker. And it's the one thing that the Romney people hadn't prepared for. I think they had, you know, a few weeks to get ready for the Perry entrance into the race and Perry's emergence, but they really got blindsided in the last couple of weeks by this Gingrich surge, as you put it, so they're rushing, and there's not a lot of time left, and this week we see the Romney people in a bit of a panic. So Saturday we'll have them face to face. They'll be standing next to each other in the middle of the stage, and I assume the moderators will sort of be doing everything they can to draw Newt and Mitt into a fight.
Now, oddly, one of the advantages that Gingrich seems to have is that he's been around for so long that all his skeletons are out of the cupboard. We know about his, you know, he's on his third wife. We know about the slightly controversial circumstances in which he left his first wife. There's all the allegations over money, over lobbying. There was the incident with his account at Tiffany's, which almost derailed his campaign earlier this year. Does that, in a sense, actually help him that there's no dirt left to find out?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it sort of goes both ways. There's sort of these there's the really old stuff, and then there's the newer stuff from earlier in the year, and then there's been months where people haven't really been paying attention to him. I don't know how, you know, there's almost a generation that's turned over since he led Republicans to Congress in 1994, and you have a lot of people who were voting who, at that time, who certainly anybody under the age of 35 wasn't a voting member of the electorate when Gingrich was last a sort of major national figure. So I think even though the media may take for granted that voters or assume the voters know all this stuff, I'm not sure how familiar it is. You know, I think there's a lot of Republicans who know him as a guy who's on Fox News a lot, who's smart, clever, very combative towards Obama, but don't necessarily have, I think, a sort of rich an inventory of his failings. But I think generally you're right. I think generally there's a sense that we've heard the worst that's come out of Gingrich, but I'm not sure we've heard it all together in one sort of paragraph of criticism. And that, I think, is what the Romney people are trying to get together
this week.
That he's personally undisciplined and that he's sort of led this life as a Washington insider and gotten rich off of it.
Yeah, and looking ahead to the eventual presidential election, you know, you've spent a lot of time talking to people on, you know, within the Obama administration, within his campaign. They'd prefer to be fighting against Newt Gingrich, wouldn't they?
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think it's a sort of new recognition that they've come to quite recently that's a real possibility. And I don't know anybody on the left that in the end thinks that Gingrich would be as formidable. He'd be unpredictable, and I think there are some people in politics who prefer predictability to unpredictability, but that's about it. Yeah, people think that Gingrich has the potential to be a major disaster for Republicans if he were the nominee, both being sort of ideologically to the right of Romney and where they think the country is, but also somebody who managed to say some absolutely incredible things and probably would be unable to go 6 months without dropping at least a couple of them.
No, indeed. Now, one person who won't be taking part in this debate is John Huntsman. He's still in the race, but he didn't reach it. He's not at 5% in the polls in Iowa, and according to the rules there, that means he can't take part in the debate. Instead, he's going to be in New Hampshire, which holds the first primary just after the Iowa caucuses. What chance does Huntsman have of pulling out a surprise, say, third place, perhaps even second place in New Hampshire, and becoming sort of the other alternative, if you like, in the race?
I mean, I think there may have been a slight uptick in that chance, but I think it's still pretty far-fetched. You know, Romney's now under pressure, and I think there's some possibility that if the country or Republican primary voters sort of witness this Newt Mitt one-on-one pummeling over the next few weeks, that they both could start to look bad. And for you can imagine, for Romney supporters in New Hampshire, Huntsman is a sort of natural fallback. On paper, the guys are very similar, and both have in various ways sort of presented themselves as you know, a sort of centrist businessman in the race. So that's possible, but the Huntsman campaign has been really disjointed. And this week, after spending the last 6 months trying to be the moderate in the field, he's now reintroducing himself as a consistent conservative. It's pretty clear that Huntsman doesn't really know whether he wants to be to the left of the field in which he's running or to the right of it. And he's still sort of sorting that out, and I think it's a little late to be doing so.
And if you are still sorting that out, then you perhaps shouldn't call yourself a consistent conservative.
Exactly right. Yeah.
One other candidate I just want to ask you about before we go, and that's Ron Paul, who's polling at 18% in the latest polls, level with Romney behind Newt Gingrich. What's his appeal to Republicans in the primaries?
Yeah, I mean, so the indications we get is that a lot of the people who support him and did in 08 and in smaller numbers are not traditional Republicans and people who, you know, might not be in the process. Otherwise, he's definitely the most sort of anti-establishmentarian of the bunch, you know, very, you know, supports abolishing the Federal Reserve, the most aggressively libertarian, and he has a sort of, you know, appeal in an era where there's a lot of skepticism about the establishment. He's the one guy who is sort of always sat outside of it, and I think that sustained, and sort of as there's been sort of increased suspicion of the financial sector and a real desire to sort of retrench from the global economy that some of the Paul opposition to monetary policymakers has caught on. Paul's also running just a more mainstream style campaign than they did last time. You know, he's talking more about his personal faith, which you need to do to appeal to rural conservatives in Iowa, and it's a little more of a sort of broad based check the boxes conservative campaign this year, and I think he's probably expanding his appeal because of that.
But this is more, I mean, for him running, it's more about, you know, making a point and shifting the debate to his issues and, you know, perhaps getting a slot at the convention rather than actually becoming the nominee, really.
Yeah, I'm not even sure he'd want a slot at the convention. He's so far outside both culturally and politically the mainstream. I mean, he ran for president, few people remember this, in 1988 as a member of the Libertarian Party, which basically sets itself up, you know, outside the two-party system. And this is, to some degree, wanting to be the Republican nominee is a late-in-life conversion towards mainstream acceptability. So, you know, he has a real constituency, and his son, Rand Paul, who was just elected to the Senate last year from Kentucky, looks like the sort of heir apparent. So I think we could be in the midst of a new dynasty where Rand picks up the torch in 2016, and we see Rand Paul run for president a few times, and that, you know, for as long as we can see 15 or 20% of a Republican primary field is being taken up by a Paul with a sort of quirky libertarian campaign.
Well, that's something to look forward to. Sasha Eisenberg in Washington, thank you very much. We're going to be talking about Newt Gingrich's unusual PhD thesis in a moment. But first, it's time for a song. And since we're talking about America, this is America by Prince. That was America by Prince. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world. In London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo. Where you can find a full range of Monocle products, perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package, looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics. Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, if Newt Gingrich does become president, he'll be the first to hold a PhD since Woodrow Wilson. But what does his PhD thesis say about him? The subject is rather surprising, particularly for a right-wing Republican: education policy in the Belgian Congo. Belgium, particularly under King Leopold, was one of the crueler colonial powers. According to Adam Hochschild's superb book, King Leopold's Ghost, some 10 million Congolese lost their lives under his rule. Yet Gingrich somehow managed to find some positives. Laura C. is an assistant professor at Morehouse University, and she's read Newt's thesis, so we don't have to. Laura, what does he say?
Well, it's a bit dated, but his task was to determine whether the Belgians succeeded or failed in their educational policy in the Congo. And Gingrich concludes that they largely failed, but he sees their task as a noble one, that sort of they tried to bring education, bring the modern world to the Belgian Congo.
And so he thinks that there was some sort of benefits to Belgian rule in Congo.
He does, yeah. He argues that the Congolese were in need of modernization, that people in the Congo before the Belgians arrived were living a very sort of primitive lifestyle that hadn't prepared them for the modern world, and so that educational policy by the Belgians was designed to try and bring the Congolese kind of forward into this sort of idealized modernity.
And most academics working on Congo, you know, like yourself, would disagree with that thesis, really, wouldn't you?
We would, yeah, and I certainly would disagree with a lot of that thesis. Belgian education policy was extraordinarily harmful to most Congolese. It limited the vast majority to somewhere between a fourth grade to a sixth grade education, so it left them vastly unprepared. Many were still illiterate by the time they finished their limited education. Many could not do, you know, basic mathematical skills and very little in the way of critical reasoning skills. And the system also limited Congolese from the highest levels of educational attainment. So no one was allowed to study to become a doctor, for example, or to try to, you know, become a lawyer, become an accountant, enter the professions. And the sort of cumulative effects of this were quite disastrous for the Congo. When the country became independent in 1960, there were fewer than 20 university-level graduates. There were no indigenous doctors, and very few people, you know, capable of running a modern state.
And when he was researching this thesis, what struck me as particularly interesting was that he not only did he not go to Congo, but he didn't seem to, or it doesn't appear to have actually spoken to anyone who's actually Congolese, be there in America or also Belgium where he went.
Right, and that does seem to be the case. The dissertation is based primarily on archival research in the colonial archives in Brussels, and there's very little indication that he talked to anyone, not just that he didn't talk to Congolese, and certainly there was a large Congolese diaspora population in Brussels in the late 60s and early 70s when he was doing his research. But he also didn't talk to any of the people in the Belgian government who had been involved in the colonial ministry and who had been involved in developing and implementing these policies. And given that he was writing this project, you know, only about 10 years after independence, certainly some of those people were still alive and still you know, capable of giving their thoughts on it. But that doesn't seem to have been part of his project. It seems to have been only designed around archival research.
Now, he wrote this in 1970, 1971. I mean, obviously, if we're looking at it now, a lot of sort of conventional wisdom about colonialism has changed, has modernized somewhat. But even then, were lots of academics at the time, did they understand that actually, you know, the colonialism wasn't a great thing and that it was, on the whole, mainly a disaster?
Yes, there definitely, I mean, there were kind of two schools of thought at the time. One was that independence had happened too quickly in Africa and that Africans, the perspective was that Africans weren't ready to govern themselves. But by far the dominant perspective in academics at that time, and particularly among academics who study Congo, is that Belgian colonial policy in all areas, not just education, had been a total disaster. The first half of the 1960s were quite tumultuous in Congo. As soon as independence happened, you had several secessionist movements. The most famous of those is the Katanga Rebellion that led to a UN peacekeeping mission where Dag Hammarskjöld was killed in a plane crash. But you also had other smaller rebellions that are not as well known, like the Mulele Rebellion in the Kivu provinces. In the east. And so Patrice Lumumba, who at the time was the prime minister, had a great deal of trouble getting the country under control. Many, many people died. There were famines as a result of all the insecurity. People couldn't harvest their crops, and so you had widespread malnutrition in the east of the country. And it was really a very chaotic time until Colonel Mobutu, with some assistance and backing from the intelligence services in Belgium and the United States, overthrew Lumumba. Lumumba was eventually assassinated and took over and established a hardline dictatorship. And of course, we know the effects of that were quite disastrous as well. But the perception in 1970, I mean, it was very clear that colonialism had not adequately prepared the Congo for independence. And Gingrich acknowledges this in the thesis. But he also takes a view that that things weren't as bad in the 60s in Congo as prevailing wisdom. And that's just a very odd claim to make, and one that I don't, you know, I can't purport to get inside his head, but there's absolutely no evidence that things weren't that bad in Congo in the early
60s
in particular.
So what does this say about Gingrich and his view on the world, if he has this sort of, or certainly did 40 years ago, you know, had this view of colonialism? What do you think that says to you about, you know, a man who wants to be president of the United States, a country which, of course, you know, had its own issues with colonialism?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it definitely shows that he's a traditionalist, and someone who tends to, at least at the time, who tended to side with the authorities and believe that even if a policy was a failure, that what the authorities thought was best is what should usually be, you know, you should sort of defer to the wisdom and expertise of those in charge. I'm a bit hesitant to say that, you know, what Gingrich wrote in his dissertation 40 years ago is what he thinks today.
Sure. And it's unlikely to come up in any presidential debate as well, I guess.
Sure. I mean, none of us would like to be judged on our dissertations. Writing a dissertation is a really miserable process. And usually doing it when you're exhausted and sort of living on caffeine and beer. And it's, I would hate to think that defines all of his intellectualism. But I do think that one thing that it shows, you know, he did manage to finish this. And it takes a lot of tenacity and a lot of persistence. And I think Gingrich has those skills and will use them as we watch the debate.
We can give him that then. We can give him tenacity. Yeah. Okay, Laura C., Assistant Professor at Morehouse University, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London.
Who's equity? Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 taget, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It's just gone 18:30 here on Midori House on Monocle 24. We're off to Dubai in a moment, but first the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Steve. As EU leaders gathered in Brussels for their crucial summit, the European Central Bank acted to soften a looming recession and avert a credit crunch by cutting interest rates and offering banks long-term funds, but doused hopes of dramatic crisis-fighting action in the euro area. British Prime Minister David Cameron said he would veto any treaty to fix the European Union's debt crisis if it failed to protect the interests of Britain, in remarks aimed at reassuring Eurosceptic members of his ruling Conservative Party. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin is in little immediate danger of being toppled by a wave of opposition protests, but they could mark the beginning of the end for him if he does not make changes to restore his legitimacy. A Syrian pipeline carrying oil from the east of the country to a vital refinery in Homs was blown up today in what the official news agency Sana said was an act of sabotage by an armed terrorist group. Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, doing well in parliamentary elections, said today it would shun a new council set up by military rulers to help oversee the drafting of a new constitution. Algeria's Islamists in the political wilderness since their last attempt to win power dissolved into civil war are now trying again, galvanised by the success of their brethren elsewhere in North Africa in the wake of the Arab Spring. An Israeli airstrike on a car killed two militants and wounded two other men on a crowded Gaza street today, the Israeli army and local medical officials said. The United States has denied it was trying to delay a new global climate deal until 2020, saying it supported an EU proposal that aims to chart a path to a more ambitious pact to fight climate change. Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari is stable and resting in a Dubai hospital and will undergo further tests, according to his doctor, the presidential spokesman said on Thursday, hoping to quell speculation the unpopular leader might resign. Fighter jets bombed the southern Somali town of Badhadir on Thursday today, killing at least one civilian, according to local residents. And Laos has suspended a $3.5 billion dam project on the lower Mekong River, while Japan leads a study into the environmental impact after activists and some neighbouring states said it would harm the livelihoods of millions of people. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. Now, Dubai is better known for its shopping than its superior healthcare, but that may be changing. As we just heard in the news headlines, President Asif Ali Zardari left Pakistan for a medical checkup in Dubai today, prompting questions about what the city has to offer health-wise. Bloomberg reporter and Monocle contributor Lara Satrakian joins us on the line now from Dubai. Lara, if I'm an authoritarian leader with a dodgy hip, should I be heading to Dubai?
There are plenty of reasons, Steve. Dubai itself marketing itself as this hub for medical tourism, as a place to be if you want to get outpatient treatments, dentistry, plastic surgery. Why not come, shop a bit, hang by the beach? They claim that nationally, as the United Arab Emirates, they're doing $17 billion a year in medical tourism, that it's up 15% year on year. They've made a tremendous effort. They've set up free zones, a Dubai healthcare city, Abu Dhabi's Sheikh Khalifa medical city, a sense here that they really want to bring people in from this radius of countries that would be attracted to Dubai. And they're pitching themselves also on cost, that treatments here can be up to 50% less than in the West. So again, this kind of destination travel for your surgeries, for some chance to see another city and do everything one would do in the glitz and glamour of Dubai.
Well, indeed. And is this government-led initiative, or is it mainly coming from the private sector?
It's very much government-led. This is part of their strategic diversification away from oil, especially for Dubai. Dubai's business model is all about footfall. They need to get people here, get them into the hotels, filling the apartments, spending in those shopping malls. And you see it with the type of medical tourists that by and large come here. They're from the region, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Oman. They like Dubai. They find it relaxing. Why not get a checkup while they're at it? A lot of them enjoy the benefits of state-sponsored health care, subsidized treatments. They can spend that money here. And that's really driving the infrastructure spend for Dubai. They have tremendous domestic and regional needs. There is a public health care boom slash crisis in effect, given the rates of obesity just around 30%, diabetes just below that. So they're building for their own people, but then trying to attract in others to create an industry out of this.
And the people, the sort of people it's attracting, obviously, you know, there's the occasional president like Zardari. But aside from that, are we talking, you know, big business people? Are we talking people mainly from the Middle East, or are they coming from further afield?
Well, I've seen it go two ways. You see the clientele from the Middle East, and then you see that outreach. Abu Dhabi just signed a pact with South Korea for patient referrals and technology, medical equipment. But it's interesting, Steve, I've also heard a lot about surgeons coming in from Beverly Hills, from kind of glitzy areas, and setting up shop, kind of a pop-up surgery industry here. Then you'll have clients coming in from around the Gulf to get their fill-in-the-blank procedures. So they're doing what they can to attract people. Some of it is private initiative, but by and large, it is this state strategy. Saudi Arabia doing the same. Again, largely driven by its domestic healthcare needs. They're spending billions on hospitals and facilities, whatever they can do to better serve their populations. But in the end, they're also doing this because they want to stimulate demand and they want to attract people to this part of the world. Everyone's getting in the same game. Qatar's doing it with a partnership with Cornell Medical Center. Jordan's putting down money to stimulate its medical tourism sector, Dead Sea treatments. Lebanon is becoming, you know, all but central point for plastic surgery. Their bank's offering loans for nose jobs and other assorted lifts. So this is really a game a lot of people are trying to play.
So it's not just actual treatments, it's a lot of plastic surgery and cosmetic surgery as well.
Absolutely. Elective surgeries. That's what they want to get here. They don't want the chronically ill. They want the elective, relatively healthy patient coming here to spend 3 or 4 days convalescing in comfort. Dubai is a big spa destination. There are a lot of ways to recover here in style.
And you mentioned that, you know, you've got doctors coming from Beverly Hills and setting up shop there. Who are the doctors who are behind this boom? Are there any, how many of them are local, and or are most of them really coming from further afield?
A lot of them coming from Europe, from Eastern Europe, from the U.S. There has been a bit of a fiasco here around licensing, quality control. That's been a concern. There have been calls for Dubai to establish a medical tourism board to regulate quality control. Just the sense here that there, you're not going to find the same standards you're going to find in the West, but you're not going to find the same prices either.
Indeed. And one last question. For actual Emiratis, what's their healthcare like?
It's full ride. It's cradle-to-grave welfare state for citizens of the Gulf, full citizens. So they enjoy tremendous benefits. They can also go abroad for treatment. We see, of course, a lot of that medical tourism coming from the Gulf, but a lot of Gulfies going to Morocco, London, the U.S. for their treatments, and often the state will help them pay.
Okay, Lara Satrakian in Dubai, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on M24.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. If you want to tune into The Curator this week, I believe the host is Mr. Hugo MacDonald, our design editor. Now, it is 18:39 here in London, and it's time for another song. This is Don't Take It Too Hard by Tuomo. That was Don't Take It Too Hard by Tuomo. Now, what would the Large Hadron Collider want with an artist? Well, this week, CERN, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research in Switzerland, announced its first artist in residence, a 28-year-old light artist, Julius von Bismarck. Molecular physics and abstract installation may seem like awkward bedfellows, but CERN's team of super scientists insist that its arts programme will foster understanding in creativity between the disciplines. A little earlier, Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, spoke to Ariane Cook, the founder of CERN's cultural policy and director of the Collide at CERN Artist Residency Programme. Sophie started by asking her exactly what CERN does and how art fits in.
So CERN is the world's largest science laboratory, and it's got over 480 different institutions from 100 countries around the world, all working together to further knowledge, particularly within particle physics. And as you know, it also houses the world's largest machine as well, the Large Hadron Collider, which is 27 kilometers in circumference. Sir Norman Foster, the great architect, called it one of the great wonders of the world, and it really is one of the great wonders of the world. It's a 27-kilometer tunnel in which we're recreating the moments after the Big Bang, when the universe was created, and looking at how and why it was formed in the way it is. But there are many other experiments which are happening here as well, spanning everything from tomography for cancer to, for example, unlocking the secrets of clouds, or even the secrets of gravity itself.
And tell me, you have launched and you're in charge of the CERN's cultural policy initiative. How does art and culture play a role at CERN?
I created this cultural programme at CERN, and the flagship of the cultural programme is the Collide at CERN Artist Residency Programme. And Collide is a deliberate pun on Collider, like Large Hadron Collider, but also Collide as in kaleidoscope and different things colliding with each other. And in essence, I call Collide at CERN CERN's greatest experiment, colliding elements even more elusive than the Higgs boson. And those elements are creativity, ingenuity, and the human imagination.
I mean, most people would think that CERN would be the last place they'd find artists. Do you think that you're trying to sort of break down those barriers between art and science?
We are definitely trying to break down the barriers between art and science at CERN. And we're also trying to break down the barriers between notions of creativity only being lodged, for example, within the arts. It's equally lodged within science. And that's where the two connect. Creativity, the impulse to go beyond paradigms, is shared by both. But art and science express them in different ways. Science through formulas, and the arts through the senses, and expression through the senses and imagination.
And you just announced a residency, a 28-year-old German artist. Can you tell me a bit about him and why you've given him this this opportunity to work with the scientists at CERN?
Basically, we chose an outstanding candidate who's Julius von Bismarck, who's studying with Olafur Ellison in Berlin. And he was chosen because he showed an amazing imagination. He did an incredible preview tape, which we asked everybody to do a video online. And he did a wonderful video online in which he had negative double echo. So he was mimicking the whole big hot topic at the moment of neutrinos following going faster than the speed of light by creating a similar thing with a negative echo. So sometimes you heard his words before he actually spoke, or sometimes you heard them afterwards. He obviously did it with double recording, but it was playful and very, very brilliant. And his work shows an imagination in which he grasps with philosophical and scientific concepts and then really hones them down into a simple idea. So, for example, in the city of Leuven, he did a giant smiley face. It's a piece called Public Face 2. And it lit up on lighthouses according to the emotions of the people within the township at the time. So he very much believes in public intervention using technology and digital arts to do those interventions, but also do them in a very powerful, very simple, but very deceptively powerful way.
And how do you think some of the scientists are going to respond to, you know, these giant smiley faces and things like that? Do you think that they will learn from his work? And is that the idea?
In terms of what the engagement, in terms of the scientists here, they are nothing but curious. I think particle physicists are the most curious species on the planet because they're looking at our universe and they're just endlessly curious. So I think they will be totally endlessly curious about this extraordinary artist. It shows very much what I believe, that we should be going back to the future and really accepting that people can be artists and scientists too.
That was Sophie Grove speaking to CERN's Ariane Cook. And now for an example of the cross-fertilisation of art and science, we're joined on the line by David Glowacki, a quantum physicist whose interactive physics art project opens tomorrow at the Anolfini Gallery in Bristol. His dance room spectroscopy, I've been struggling with that word all day, spectroscopy, is an immersive artwork that uses 3D imaging technologies and choreography to explain the principles of quantum and molecular physics. David, where do we begin with this? Quantum physics is, I think, to most people, pretty cryptic. Do you think this sort of artwork helps to explain it?
Well, I think that you can, because the exhibition is actually based on completely rigorous physics, just by standing and watching the exhibition. If I'm around in the background chatting to some of the patrons, I can actually explain certain aspects of mechanics to them, like tunneling phenomena and things like this. So yeah, if you know what to look for, you can actually start to gain an intuitive understanding of how the sort of laws of motion work.
Can you, and this might be impossible, but can you begin to describe what this art installation looks like? Can you visualize this for us?
Yeah, I can describe it. There's a lot of videos and things on my website that people can look at if they're interested further, but I can do a sort of first approximation. So what we do is I'm a quantum chemist, I should specify. So
okay.
I'm generally interested in things that are slightly bigger than the sorts of things they're looking at CERN. I'm interested in atoms and molecules, where a lot of phenomena that are quantum are extremely important. So what we do is we simulate a bunch of atoms based on the laws of quantum mechanics, and we project it into the room in an art museum. Either we've done it in domes, we can do it on flat screens, we can do it any sort of thing. So we simulate all these particles, so you actually see the particles, and what happens is you see the particles in the room. They're bouncing around, interacting with each other. And in the absence of anybody being in the room, the only thing the particles feel is they feel every single other particle. So the energy field, if you like, that any particle feels just depends on where all the other particles are at any point in time. But what happens when somebody steps in the room is they are actually an external energy field that the particles immediately in real time respond to and self-assemble around. So the minute you step into the room, you induce an instantaneous field, a virtual field in the room, and you see the effects of it on the projections. And simultaneous to that, we use a bunch of tricks from laser spectroscopy, and we convert the chaos of the particle system into soundscapes. So as people, either individually or in big groups, the project's actually more interesting when big groups of people are cooperating to do things. They simultaneously shape the visuals and mold the soundscape, all in real time, based on real physics.
So does this work then, or you hope it works, as much as an art installation as a science project?
Yeah, I mean, I made it initially not as a science project. I made it because when I go and hang out with my friends at dinner parties and things like this, people ask me what I do. And
and you say, hey, I'm a quantum chemist.
And what I find is, now that I've gotten a little bit older, I've gotten more bored of that question. I mean, I'm extremely enthusiastic to answer the question. What I've found is that I haven't found a great way of explaining it, which captivates people. Inevitably, their eyes sort of glaze over. So I have a lot of friends that are artists, so I thought I would take what I study every day. And now when people ask me that question, I can kind of show them something that's much more tangible and intuitive.
And have you found that that's actually helping, that, you know, you show this project to people and they have a greater understanding of what it is you do?
Yes. When they experience it, they have a much more intuitive feel for the sorts of laws and rules that the microscopic world is governed by. What's happened is, now when I go to a dinner party, everyone asks me about this project, and this project's hard to explain as well, right? Unless you see it. So really,
so you still don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, I still don't have an answer. Sorry.
Now, do you think that, I mean, you know, when we talk about art and science, they're seen as, you know, to most people, they're seen as, you know, almost opposites. You know, one's very creative, one's very, and one's seen as more sort of, you know, there's a right and a wrong. But do you think there really is a crossover that we should appreciate a bit more?
I think that the crossover, there's a few different aspects to this question. I think the first crossover is the communication element. So a lot of the most successful scientific theories, and actually a lot of unsuccessful scientific theories that gain a lot of inertia but then are sort of swept under the rug years later, arise because people have been effective communicators. And so communication, because we're humans, is an absolutely critical part of any sort of communication, including science. And there's a number of examples of people that have published sort of impenetrable work, right, years previous to some other guy who comes up with the same thing but explains it in a better way. And then the guy that explains it in the way that everybody understands it, well, he wins the Nobel Prize or something. So I think that communication is critical, and art does a lot of communication. But another sort of important crossover between art and science, I think, is that art and science are both on some level seeking to construct representations of the world around us. So artists are doing this all the time. I mean, there's sort of extremely obvious examples of this, like Monet's water lilies, right? But there's less obvious examples as well, if you think of maybe some Picasso or something like this. And that's what scientists are doing. They're also constructing representations of reality. Now, granted, what a scientist wants to do with the representation of reality, maybe make a computer or something, the applications are slightly different. But I think at root, they're on some level that they are doing similar things. And so there is some fertile crossover territory there.
And do you think, you know, looking at this from an educational point of view, you know, we all remember our science classes, and aside from, you know, the occasional experiment where we got to get something to explode, it was, you know, they tended to be quite dry and not so creative. Do you think that, you know, that art projects like this could be incredibly useful at, you know, encouraging young people to get excited about science in the first place?
Hugely. The first exhibition we did of our dance room spectroscopy was at a University of Bristol outreach day. The first day was aimed at kids, and the response we got was just absolutely amazing, because here you had physics, you have math, you have computer science, but this, and you have video, but then you also have video game technology, and you have sort of cool graphics, and then you have dance movement, and you have the sort of playful dimension. So kids love this. Adults love it too, but I feel like kids oftentimes are a tough test, because you sort of, they don't like something, they're extremely honest about it. And so I think that this has my, so I'm the oldest of six, and my little sister and brother have shown their classes this, and I've gotten several calls from schools who have said, can you come and give a talk about this and get our kids excited about science? So yeah, I think these sorts of projects have a real role in captivating people and inspiring people to show them that science isn't just a bunch of nerds doing obscure things. Fun, you know?
Excellent. Well, look, David Glorecki, thank you very much, and good luck with the project. That's it for this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump. It was researched by Hannah Jenkins, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Nick Kelly is here with headlines in just a moment. And at the top of the hour, Andrew Tuck is here with this week's first broadcast of The Urbanist. Our colleagues on The Monocle Daily, and I think it's Hugo MacDonald and Tyler Brulé tonight, will be here at 2200 hours London time to kick off the day in Asia. But here's one last song to play us out. This is Don't Upset the Rhythm by The Noisettes. Don't upset the rhythm, no. Don't upset the rhythm. Don't upset the rhythm, no. Don't upset the rhythm. The time is right. The sun is sleeping in the sky.